his wife.
Well, they kept in touch with us all my career, as long as they lived, as a matter of fact. And every time Liz and I were back in Indiana, he'd have left word with my brother, the man, that they wanted us to come over for lunch with him in South Bend. The family had moved to South Bend at that time. But he was a very unusual guy in a way. He had a good family, and being as well-to-do as he was, they all amounted to something. His eldest son was a Phi Beta Kappa at Harvard and a Rhodes Scholar.
Very unusual for
very unusual,
coming from a wealthy family like that.
So we got a little third place for lunch many times, quite a number of times. And the payoff for the whole thing was when I was inaugurated president of Carnegie, Mr. and Mrs. Sanders, I saw that they were invited and they came to the inauguration. Mm-hmm. And they went to a reception at our president's house afterwards. And gee, you'd think it. Something had shone on him from heaven, really. Mr. Sanders said he never made such a good investment.
So you really had then two very important people in your early career, your
That's
high school
right.
teacher
and Mr.
and
Sanders.
Your father's former employer.
Yeah.
Both very important. And getting back to Indiana then, you majored in chemistry or in physics?
I majored in chemistry and minored in physics. I took most of the undergraduate physics courses.
And you found them actually pretty easy courses on the whole?
Yeah. All of it was very classical, descriptive and classical. Physics, there were one or two people in physics that were good teachers. Dutcher and Hufford.
H-U-F-F-A-R-D?
Yes, he was a Penn PhD. All of these people, every instructor, at least every instructor I had, and I know every instructor in chemistry and physics, and most all of them, all but one in math, were undergraduates at Indiana University. It was the most inbred place you ever ran into. Most of them had gone somewhere else. Well, it isn't true. O.W. Brown was not an undergraduate. He was the only one in chemistry who was not an undergrad. Didn't do an undergraduate work at Indiana. He did his undergraduate work at Little Hanover College.
Oh, yes. And that's Harvey Wiley's old school as well.
And then he went to his graduate work at the University of Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know whether, I never knew whether O.W. Brown got a doctorate at Wisconsin. My impression is that they call him Dr. Brown now, but my impression is that he didn't get a doctorate at Wisconsin, got a master's degree at Wisconsin, and that his old school, Hanover, gave him an honorary doctorate.
Mm-hmm.
But all the rest of them, outside of Brown, they all were undergraduates. The head of the department, Lyons, did his doctorate, as so many did in those days, in Germany, at Heidelberg.
Mm-hmm.
May, at Columbia.
M-A-Y?
M-A-Y, Clarence May at Columbia. Mathers at Cornell.
So they had some, actually some pretty... at least there were some pretty respected graduates that were on the faculty there. Since they're where they got their degrees.
Yeah, but they...
They weren't doing a lot of first-rate research there during their
degree. Well, there's hardly any, except for O.W. Brown and Mathers. But it was not very exciting research. I suppose Brown had students that did better graduate work than anybody else.
Well, as an undergraduate now, you worked as a lab assistant in the chemistry department?
Yeah, I became running sections of qualitative analysis.
No, that's for freshmen and sophomores, I guess.
Well, there it was general chemistry. It was a just a first semester course on qualitative analysis, second semester course. But they meet 5 days a week. And then that happened. I started being an assistant in qualitative analysis in my second year. In my third year, I was in charge of the whole course.
You actually taught the whole course? And,
yeah.
Well, that's very unusual, I mean, to have an undergraduate to do that.
Yeah.
Because presumably you taught students who you knew probably pretty well on campus from other activities and the like.
Well, I think I kept my good senses about it. I remember a few fellows that I knew personally that weren't doing well, and I just flunked them. I think I had high standards about handling students from the start. One of them that I had quite a lot of trouble about was a pre-med. They all had to take the general and qualitative analysis, you know. Whose father was the head of the Lutheran Hospital in Fort Wayne, a very prominent doctor. And this boy was just playing around. I gave him plenty of warning, but he didn't straighten out, and so he had to repeat the course.
Well, sometimes it's a good lesson and has to be done as soon as possible.
Well, where were we?
We're talking about the chemistry department. During your undergraduate,
I would say that it was a very obsolete department. The equipment was essentially the equipment you needed for teaching the undergraduate courses. In getting into research, you generally made your own equipment. I got to be, for example, a pretty damn good glass blower.
You had to be at that department.
Had to be, yeah.
The bigger departments, they have glass blowers who work.
Oh, I haven't heard of them. Okay. I won the glass blower at Canadian Tech when I first came in. But I guess when I first came to Carnegie Tech, I was the best glass blower in the around.
So you were a very valuable man in the department.
I got imposed on. You became pretty clever. You wanted an autoclave, something to do something under pressure, you'd make it out of pipe fittings, you know. Mm-hmm. And I learned to use the physics department had a machine shop that the chemistry graduate students could use, you see. I learned to use a good bit of metal lathes and that kind of stuff.
So in a way, you'd almost think, from your own experience, you'd almost think that if a student has a great deal of talent, you can't keep that student away from doing well in his field. I mean, sometimes you can go to chemistry departments and they'll be loaded with very expensive equipment, but there's creativity and there's something that won't stop a good student from succeeding. And I think
you've got to have a hell of a lot of drive and ambition. I think a lot of students went through Indiana graduate school that never amounted to a hell of a lot, but. I said one thing about Otterby Brown was that he worked in the laboratory himself. He was there almost all the time. And if you needed a little help, he usually had some suggestions.
Just tracking back a minute, you graduated from Indiana University in 1919.
Yeah.
And then you decided to go on to graduate school at Indiana as well.
Yeah.
Was there any particular reason why you they didn't go then to some of the bigger schools?
Because Indiana made it so damn easy for me to stay. See, as a graduate, they made me an instructor and paid me $80 a month. as a graduate student. I should have had enough guts to turn that down and go someplace else.
But you just do, but because of all the...
It's so easy. And besides, I was starting to have a heavy girlfriend there.
Yes, I figured something like that might be playing a role, too. It's funny how sometimes decisions are so complex.
But, look, the real trouble with Indiana University at that time was, I said, it was obsolete. Here, Brown was a professor of physical chemistry. He didn't really believe, didn't quite believe even in Arrhenius' theory.
He was a student of someone at Wisconsin, but
Collenberg, who was an anti-Arrhenius guy.
Right, and that's where Brown got his ideas from.
And here, I never heard a word about chemical thermodynamics. I never heard a word about modern solution theory. I never heard anything about modern theories of kinetics or quantum chemistry. Now, you have to remember, of course, that the year I got my doctorate, 23, was the year that Lewis and Randall was published. And that was a book that really taught chemists generally to understand chemical thermodynamics and to apply it. Although in the good institutions, the good graduate schools, there were professors who were teaching chemical thermodynamics. You had at Penn was Herb Harnett, for example. Herbert Harnett, H-A-R-N-A-D, who later went to Yale. And Joel Hildebrand was at Penn in his early days. Very modern knowledge of solution theory and acid-based theory.
W.A. Noyes, Jr., I guess, who was at MIT and then at Caltech.
A.A. Noyes.
And Wilder Bancroft, for example,
Bancroft was sort of a strange physical chemist in a way. He was a sort of a documentary, he was a sort of a colloid or surface chemist. Mm-hmm. But at MIT, at Harvard, at Yale, they were teaching modern state of physical science.
Yeah, Johns Hopkins had some good people.
Hopkins did. Also, and in Berkeley, of course. Berkeley and Caltech, Chicago. There the students came away with some understanding of the modern state of physical science. This was very bad in Indiana. See, I came away... Well, 23 was the same year in which Debye and Hickel published their new theories of electrolytes.
Exactly.
23, by the way, was the year that the first unit process chemical engineering book, Walker, Lewis, and McAdams, was published.
Right. Very important book.
Yeah. So, in a way, excuse the obsolescence of Indiana University by saying that these things were not common property by that time, but God, the professors in the good schools were already aware of all this in the literature of chemistry, you see. I had to spend, really, when I came to Carnegie Tech, I had to spend my first 6 or 7 years just studying advanced science and mathematics in order to become acquainted, to learn the modern state of physical science and to decide on fields in which it seemed profitable to do research.
I noticed, too, you did a postdoctoral
that was part of my training.
Theoretical physics.
I went to Michigan one summer to study classical theoretical physics. I studied classical analytical dynamics with Dennison and also band spectra. I came back and also learned technique of doing infrared spectral work with a very bright graduate student and the help of a machine, good instrument maker. We built the first infrared spectrometer in Pittsburgh.
But it really took some time for you to really make up that
lost
ground.
Six or 7 years, yeah.
What was O.W. Brown like as a professor? Was he did he supervise your work very well and the like, or did he work closely with you?
He would always come and have some suggestions if you had a problem, but he encouraged you to go ahead and do it yourself, you know.
Were there any other graduate students that you can remember that later did pretty well in chemistry, or?
Well, yeah, there were a few. There wasn't a great number of graduate students in those days. Clyde Hanke was probably one of the prominent ones. He was one of Brown's students.
I'll stop it.
Hanke, other graduate student, Clyde Hanke, he went to work immediately with DuPont, and his whole career was at DuPont. He did very pragmatic catalytic work.
And this is at Wilmington. He worked at the experiment station in Wilmington.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. I don't know whether he was moved out to some of the divisions or not, but as far as I know, he spent his whole career. He's dead now. He was a bear for hard work and long hours. I don't know. He was bad enough. He was Phi Beta Kappa, I guess. But so was I. I didn't work very hard for it.
So, one thing I noticed about
another man who had a very good career was Herman Driscoll.
How do you spell his last
name? Herman, mm-hmm. Briscoe.
Oh, yeah, Briscoe. Yeah.
Herman was an undergraduate at Indiana, but then he got his master's degree at Harvard, and then got married and thought he needed some more income, and he taught chemistry at Colby, I think it was. For a couple of years, and then came back to Indiana and got a doctorate with Mathers. Briscoe was a bright, very bright guy and learned an awful lot of chemistry on his own, and he knew what was the matter with Indiana. He became head of the chemistry department. Briscoe finally became vice president for administration at Indiana. He and Herman Wells really changed the direction of Indiana University.
Was there a large agricultural school at Indiana at the time? An experiment station, an ag school at Indiana University?
No,
was that Indiana State that they?
No, it's at Purdue.
Oh, it's at Purdue. Okay.
Purdue is the A&M University in Indiana. There's no engineering and no agriculture at Bloomington.
Right. Yeah.
There's some more. A fellow by the name of Brundage was a graduate student. I can't remember his first name, but he later got interested in pharmacological chemistry, and he was his career was down in Texas. I don't know whether Texas A&M or Texas University of Texas. Is head of a department of pharmaceutical chemistry, I think. I think he made himself quite a reputation. Verling Votaw was another one who was very successful.
Could you give that name again?
Verling, V-E-R-L-I-N-G, V-O-T, O-W, I guess it is, or V-A-T-O-W,
V-O-T-O-W,
I guess.
Mm-hmm.
He went to Procter & Gamble. I think he became director of research at Procter & Gamble. Anyway, became a well-known guy.
Yeah, so there was a number of graduate students, former graduate students in Indiana, that during your period who went out and did pretty well, considering the nature of the...
Another one was Robert Fry. He has a research lab right next to mine in physical chemistry. Bob Fry was in a reserve officer in chemical warfare. In fact, in World War II, he was a colonel in charge of chemical warfare in South Pacific. And he became then director of research at the arsenal up in New Jersey, Edgewood
is in Maryland.
What is the name of it? Anyway, he was director of research. He married a Bloomington girl that we knew. We used to stop and see them on the way to vacation up in New England. Bob is dead now also. There's another chap by the name of Carrick. I think I'm right. C-A-R-R-I-C-K. I don't remember his first name.
Mm-hmm.
He did something. None of these people did a graduate thesis of very, very importance. I know Carrick did just a phase diagram for a ternary system, but he had a pretty good career. He went to Southern Illinois University.
Mm-hmm.
I think at the time he went there it was really a teacher's college, but he was there, I think, his whole career. I think he became head of chemistry. I probably could remember some others.
I think we've covered a pretty good group there. What I was going to ask, and this is somewhat...
There's another one, Lee Smith, not the organic chemist at Minnesota, who was out in industry for a while and came back and got his doctorate in organic chemistry. Then he went to work for the Eastern Laboratory of the Department of Agriculture. That's in Philadelphia, isn't it?
Right.
He was sort of a queer duck. I don't think he would last very long. I don't think he lasted very long in industry is the reason he came back. But a queer guy can last quite a long while if he keeps his nose clean in a government laboratory.
Sure. What I was going to ask you is that throughout your graduate career at Indiana, you worked at various times.
What?
You worked outside the graduate. You know, you worked at the Bartlett Company in Philadelphia for a while.
Well, that was interesting and a good experience. I went to work for Bart at the end of my junior year in college, and. Do you know Jay Bennett Hill?
No, I do.
Well, Jay Bennett Hill was a Penn PhD who was director of research out at Baird Company.
Mm-hmm.
He came through the Midwest. Hiring anybody was warm and breathing, I think.
during World War II, I guess. World War One.
Yeah, he hired me, and I just finished my junior year. I went to work down there. And had interesting work to do. There was a great demand for picric acid explosives, and that's trinitrophenol, of course. And the only phenol source up until that time was in America was byproduct coke ovens.
Mm-hmm.
And that was just a drop in a bucket, so there was great pressure on for a synthetic process to make phenol. And Dennis Bull process had been developed on a laboratory scale in, at Cornell, plus Barrett. Dennis was a Cornell professor,
mm-hmm.
and Bull was, I guess, one of the director of research. I think he later became the superintendent of this synthetic phenol plant. But when I first went there, I was assigned to the group that were doing a pilot plant work on this synthetic phenol process. They used sulfonated benzene, made sulfonic benzene, sulfonic acid, made the sodium salt, then you fused it with, originally it was solid caustic soda, and you knocked out the sulfonate group and went back to sodium tonalate. Later we learned we could do it with just a concentrated sodium hydroxide solution in autoclave.
Mm-hmm.
But that was became then, we followed that. I was on sort of a turn chemist, taking one shift.
A shift chemist, really, something like that.
Right? While we were in that pilot plant stage, and then as we were getting the plant in operation.
Must have been a great experience for you.
It was a great experience.
The university.
After that was gone, because that process was replaced later, but much after World War One by a direct chlorination of benzene, hydrolysis of that. After that plant was in operation, I was on the job of. Again, a shift chemist on separating out metaxylene from the para and orthoxylene. Metaxylene nitrated was the best stuff for anti-submarine bombs,
mm-hmm.
but it was right in the middle of the other isomers on boiling point, so it took a very, very, in those days too, fractionating columns went what they are today. But it took an extremely careful regulation of temperature on every one of the plates in the column.
Mm-hmm.
And I was on that job until we found exactly how to operate the distillation column to get it out. And then I started working on the organic bases, the pyridines and the quinolines and so on. It turned out, I came out to Pittsburgh, as a matter of fact, I was loaned to Major Dodge, who was a major in the ordnance department, and they were buying, of course, ammonium sulfate. The first big byproduct coke oven plant was out here at Clinton, PA, and they were government was buying the ammonium sulfate to make ammonium nitrate, and they were getting too damn much pyridine carried over into the ammonium sulfate. I was sent out here with Major Dodge. His flunky did the work in making a pyridine balance on the coke oven plant.
Well, what a great learning experience. Large scale experience.
Then the war was over, and at the end of Christmas time, after the war armistice, I came back to Indiana.
Mm-hmm.
Indiana had gone on a term system during the war, so that they started the second term in January.
Mm-hmm.
I had some good people to work for there, too. Chamberlain Hill was director of research.
He may have been a Smith, an Edgar Foss Smith student. I don't know, but
I don't know.
Yeah.
But J. Bennett Hill became after. Well, let me say, here was J. Bennett Hill was director of research. Rhodes, every man with the name of Rhodes, his first name is Dusty. damned if I know it. He was the head of the section. I guess maybe of the real research. Hill had engineering and all of science and technology.
Hill was like a technical superintendent or something.
Sort of like that. But anyway, Rhodes was really the head of most of this research that I talked about. But my direct boss, head of a section of a division or a section under Rhodes, was Pete Vandermeulen. He was my direct boss.
Vandermeulen?
Vandermeulen, M-U-E-L-E-N. Bennett Hill, after the war, Bennett Hill, and when I went in to tell him that I was coming back to school, said, well, I understand why you want to do that, but I want you to know you don't have to go back there. We'd like to have you stay on it. He said, you're the only guy that goes up the steps two at a time. Well, you know, Bennett Hill, then, after the war, Bennett Hill became director of research for Atlantic Refining. And then of Atlantic Richfield.
Right, which still has been.
And he kept in touch with me all these years. At ACS meetings, he'd always look me up. Find out how things was going. When there was news that I was a promoter in some way, made head of the chemistry department or something like that, I always get a letter from Bennett Hill.
Very good.
Dusty Rhodes went